Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Schon viel über Kryptowährungen gehört, aber noch keinen richtigen Zugang gefunden? Der Einstieg in Kryptowährungen muss nicht kompliziert sein. Mit Xtrackers ETCs kannst du kostengünstig in die Zukunft investieren. Einfach übers klassische Depot. Auf xtrackers.de findest du viel Wissenswertes zu dieser spannenden Anlageklasse. Nimm deine finanzielle Zukunft selbst in die Hand. Schritt für Schritt mit Xtrackers. Investitionen unterliegen Risiken. Dieser Beitrag ist eine Werbemitteilung der DWS International GmbH, Frankfurt.
I'm Katja Adler from the Global Story podcast. Today we're looking at Sudan and the brutal conflict raging there. We hear from some of the millions of civilians brutalized and displaced. It's been dubbed the Forgotten War. But is it more ignored than forgotten by the international community? And if so, why? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. The scale now of Israel's military operation in southern Lebanon can be seen in the statistics. In the past 24 hours, Israel says it struck around 1,100 Hezbollah targets, destroying tens of thousands of rockets in the south and in the Bekaa Valley. And that, says the Lebanese government, has resulted in the deaths of more than 350 people, among them women and children, and over 1,200 injured, while hospitals in the south have been told to cancel non-urgent surgery to make way for the growing number of casualties. There's also been an Israeli airstrike against a Hezbollah commander in Beirut. For its part, Hezbollah says it's fired dozens of rockets into northern Israel. It's the deadliest day yet in the intensifying conflict between Israel and Hezbollah, which flared up nearly a year ago across Lebanon's southern border. Much as it has in Gaza, Israel has warned civilians to evacuate. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israeli forces were only targeting Hezbollah.
I have a message for the people of Lebanon. Israel's war is not with you. It's with Hezbollah. For too long, Hezbollah has been using you as human shields. The IDF has warned you to get out of harm's way. I urge you, take this warning seriously. Don't let Hezbollah endanger your lives and the lives of your loved ones. Don't let Hezbollah endanger Lebanon. Please, get out of harm's way now. Once our operation is finished, you can come back safely to your homes.
Well, a short time ago, we managed to get through to Zahra Sawley, a 20-year-old student who lives with her family, just outside the southern Lebanese city of Nabatea, in a flat they've been renting since February after leaving her home village on the border with Israel due to the ongoing exchange of fire.
I woke up at 6 a.m. to the sound of booming and all of that. It was like multiple strikes at first. It was a bit distant and started to come and more near and near to my area. By noon, almost, it started to get very intense, and I saw a lot of strikes around my area. I heard them all, a lot of glass shattering.
And these were Israeli warplanes firing missiles.
Right. And yes. We can hear the planes all night almost. And by the morning, we started to hear the strikes and plus the airplanes. We didn't dare to get out of our house, but we did see a lot of smoke and we did hear a lot of, there was the building besides our building, there was a building between my house and another building that collapsed. I didn't see it clearly, but it was indeed a building with civilian inside. And I heard a lot of ambulance coming and fire trucks and all of that.
Are you going to stay where you are? Do you feel safe enough?
I think that staying outside my house will cause the... Okay. I don't know if you heard that, but that was a strike right there.
That sort of boom in the background.
Yes, yes, they're still going. Yeah, they are coming closer.
Is it safe for you to continue, Zara?
Yes.
Talking?
Yeah, for now. Yeah. We don't feel safe, obviously, but this is our land. We can't just abandon our land. Where are we supposed to go? You know, a lot of people are still stuck on the streets. Some streets were bombed, I heard. And a lot of my friends are still stuck since morning. They are still stuck in traffic because a lot of people are trying to flee. It caused a huge traffic jam and around.
I mean, they say that this has been the worst bombardment by Israel.
Yes.
For nearly a year now. Is that how it feels, that it's very intense?
Yes, certainly.
Who do you look to protect you from what is happening now?
There are people to protect us, obviously.
Who is protecting you?
I think it's pretty clear who is protecting us.
I just wonder whether you ever wished that Hezbollah would stop firing rockets into northern Israel, if this is what happens. No,
I've never wished that, actually. I've never wished that. I'm pretty well protected.
That was Zara Soli, a 20-year-old student who lives with her family just outside the southern Lebanese city of Nabatea. Well, it's the Lebanese health minister, Firas Abiad, who's been giving daily updates on the number of deaths and injuries caused by the Israeli airstrikes. I asked him about the scale of the attacks today.
Our understanding is that there has been over 500 airstrikes in different locations, whether in southern Lebanon, in Bika, and also in other areas. The vast majority, if not all, of the sites that were targeted were civilian. Some of them were residential buildings. And we had this number of casualties really mounting very fast.
But Israel says it's been targeting sites that are linked to Hezbollah, and that Hezbollah is using civilians as human shields.
Well, this is untrue. And anybody who visits the casualties or visits the sites can confirm that firsthand.
The Israeli defense of their actions is that since October the 7th, Hezbollah have launched 9,000 rocket attacks into northern Israel, which have killed dozens of Israelis. And in the words of a government spokesperson, no country in the world would put up with that level of assault. What's your response to that?
I can cite that only during the last week, the Israeli attacks have resulted in an excess of almost 500 who are dead and an excess of 5,000 who are wounded. From the start, the position of the Lebanese government is we do not want war, and we have called for a ceasefire from Gaza to Lebanon. I think that the whole population, which includes a lot of the people who have affinities to Hezbollah, do not want war. This is something that affects the whole region because it's extremely difficult for us in the Middle East, as we see the carnage that is ongoing in Gaza, to just take a watchful position.
But it's difficult for you, isn't it, Minister? I mean, you are a government and you have your own army, and yet you have this extremely powerful, separate militia group called Hezbollah that very possibly has a very different agenda to that of the Lebanese government.
And I think the best way to take any pretext of such non-state actor is to start with a ceasefire in Gaza that really removes any context to any said resistance or anything of the sort. That's why the Lebanese government believes that the good starting point of sorting this out is to have a ceasefire from Gaza to Lebanon.
How would you describe the mood in Beirut? Obviously not directly affected beyond that strike that there has been today on what Israel says was a Hezbollah operative in the south of the city.
I think that a lot of the Lebanese are rightly upset. the feeling amongst the population is that definitely we do not want to have an escalation, but we feel that this is something that's being pushed upon us for whatever aims the Israeli government has. So in the face of this aggression, we have to, all of us, work together and try to provide the best care for our community, especially the innocent people who have been wounded with these attacks.
That was Lebanon's Health Minister, Firas Abiad. And earlier today, Israel's ambassador to the UK, Tzipi Hotoveli, spoke to my colleague, Misal Hussein, about why Israel was committed to striking southern Lebanon.
First of all, we need to understand the picture. The picture is that since 8th of October, Israel is under massive attack from Hezbollah. We're talking about over 9,000 rockets being fired on our cities. And we are in a situation that I think no country in the world can tolerate, where cities in the north being evacuated, over 70,000 people lost their homes, being refugees in their own country.
And you have been striking back against that for all of this time, haven't you?
But in the end of the day, after 11 months of intensive diplomatic efforts, the result is unfortunately very poor. Hezbollah still refuses to go beyond the Litani River, as the 1701 UN Security Council resolution demands from Hezbollah. And it's still a major threat to our people. So Israel is interested in a diplomatic solution, but in the end of the day, after 11 months, we have ghost cities in the north, 70,000 people lost their homes, dozens of Israelis lost their life, including 12 children in a football game. You probably remember the Majd al-Shams attack of Hezbollah.
In the occupied Golan Heights.
They took brutally the life of 12 children in a football game.
Would you acknowledge that the moment that significantly escalated the ongoing situation that you've described was last Tuesday's pager attacks?
I'm not referring to the pager attack. Israel can only take responsibility on the things we are, you know, under our control. And under our control are the airstrikes that are targeting all those rocket launchers. The fact that we are targeting the leaders of Hezbollah, those terrorists that were planning to do another 7th of October in the Galilee, in the northern border of Israel. Those are the things we are doing.
I just want to be clear. So I understand your position on the pager attacks. Are you saying that that was not an Israeli attack?
I'm saying I'm not referring to it. And as you know, Israel is not referring to it. I think we need to go back to what we want to achieve. We're talking about a million Israelis under fire yesterday from Hezbollah's attacks. We're talking about long-range rockets that are being supplied to Hezbollah by Iran. This is the reality of this horrific terror organization that became a terror monster with military abilities. So Israel is not interested in another 7th of October. This is something the government is committed, that the citizens of the north will be back to their homes and the peace will be restored to our northern border.
We have heard this before, haven't we? Indeed, you have been in this precise situation before in 2006, for example, when there was an invasion of Lebanon designed to try and bring security to northern Israel. That didn't work. So what is the strategy here? How are you going to achieve now something that you didn't before?
Well, we're talking about a terror organization. Let's not be innocent here, like as if we're dealing with a charity organization. Hezbollah is a terror organization.
Was it any different in 2006?
We managed to restore peace and quiet to our northern border for many years since 2006. As you know, there are almost 20 years that passed. So 20 years of peace and quiet in the Middle East is a long range. It's a long time. What we want is to dismantle Hezbollah's abilities from this arsenal of rockets that came from Iran, the same Iran that is firing and backing up Russia against Ukraine, the same Iran that is a threat to the UK. We are fighting the West battle.
So we are fighting your own battle. Just to be clear, you think you can bring peace to northern Israel without a ceasefire in Gaza?
I think it's our duty to bring back the people of the north to their homes. And if a ceasefire would have been possible with our hostages being released, then we would have been in a better reality for sure. But at the moment, it's Hamas that's refusing to have a ceasefire. And it's our duty to bring the peace back to our northern cities. I think it's very simple.
That was Israel's ambassador to the UK, Tzipi Hotoveli. This is NewsHour. And coming up, the rest of region of Indian-administered Kashmir is holding elections for the first time in 10 years, but not everyone is hopeful for an end to the violence.
where is the peace, actually? Like, obviously, I know the peace is only this thing that people don't speak like they used to against whatever was happening. But now we're not allowed to say so. Yeah, everything is peaceful because nobody speaks against them.
Our top story there this hour. Lebanese health officials say Israeli airstrikes against Hezbollah have killed more than 350 people. It's the deadliest day of conflict across the border in nearly two decades. Thousands of civilians in southern Lebanon have been fleeing the bombardment. And India has confirmed a case of the new fast-spreading strain of Mpox, the first in South Asia. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour Live from the BBC in London. US federal prosecutors say they will seek to charge the suspect found hiding with a gun at Donald Trump's Florida golf course with attempting to assassinate a major political candidate. They said he wrote a note months earlier stating that he planned to kill the former president. Joined live now by Daniel Lippman in Washington, D.C. He's a reporter for Politico covering the White House. This note sounds rather intriguing.
It does. He actually predicted he would fail and offered $150,000 to, quote, whomever can complete the job. And he blasted Trump for, quote, for lacking, quote, the moral fabric that is America. And he took Trump to task on his Iran policy, blaming him for the chaos in the Middle East. And so he had placed this missive at a friend's house months ago, but we'll have to ask, why did the friend not report him, obviously?
And this note, is it central to the prosecution and charging of the accused?
It appears to be, because he was initially just charged with weapons charges because he didn't actually shoot at Trump. He, after the Secret Service shot in his direction, he fled. And so you have to look at what his motive was. Was he just scoping it out, or did he have an intention to try to kill Trump 2 months after the first assassination attempt? And so Trump has actually blasted the Justice Department for charging him with weak charges, he thought. But now they are going back to the grand jury to try to keep this guy in prison for the rest of his life.
So this note, if you like, shows some kind of motive.
Yeah, and an intention to actually kill Trump, not just, hey, this guy was near Mar-a-Lago, near the golf club with a weapon. And obviously, we know why he was there, but they need these types of critical pieces of evidence to show, hey, he was there and he wanted to kill Trump months before.
I know it happened some time ago, but has this attempted assassination of Donald Trump showed up at all in opinion polls?
Because there was no Trump showing, hey, he was valiant in surviving the attempt. Trump has not talked about this as much because he's really focusing on the economy and immigration. He doesn't want to just be about himself. So far, we haven't seen evidence of this latest attempt in the polls.
Daniel, many thanks. That was Daniel Lippman, a reporter for Politico covering the White House. For the first time in 10 years, Indian-administered Kashmir is voting in local assembly elections. It's a region which has lived through a violent insurgency for decades and has always had a tenuous relationship with Delhi. While some continue to boycott elections, there are others coming out to vote. What has changed and what do Kashmiris want from these elections? The BBC's India correspondent, Arunoday Mukherjee, reports from the region.
We're currently part of a convoy of Kashmiri politician Mr. Engineer Rashid heading to North Kashmir. His cavalcade is surrounded by supporters chanting his name and slogans in his favor. They're saying the lion has come.
Engineer Rashid is promising change. An accused in a terror funding case and in jail for the last 5 years, Rashid is now out on bail to campaign. I spoke to him about his hopes for Jammu and Kashmir.
There are two things in my politics. One is to take care of the developmental issues, governance. Second is J&K is a conflict zone, you know it. The political issue of Jammu and Kashmir, there are aspirations for resolution to Kashmir issue. So I want to carry both the things simultaneously.
He fought and won the general elections earlier this year, despite being behind bars. Rashid's campaign struck a chord with voters, still reeling under the loss of statehood and autonomy 5 years ago.
They have been cheated.
While speaking to me about what the people here have gone through, he breaks down.
I wish a day to come when there would be absolute peace, but not that of a graveyard. But peace that would really give sense of belonging to my people.
Over 100 kilometers away, in South Kashmir, people are voting in the first of the ongoing three-phase election, signaling a change in a region where election boycotts have been common in the past.
Now, there are lots of people who are walking towards a polling booth, and I'm going to try and enter. The first thing that I see are a lot of security personnel, all armed, ensuring that there is adequate security as these elections, crucial elections, are held. What's interesting is that Shopian, where I am, used to at one point be a hotbed of militancy.
Since the 1990s, an armed insurgency against Indian rule has claimed thousands of lives, including civilians and security forces. For decades, India has been accused of human rights violations and cracking down on dissent. But in the last few years, critics say this has only intensified.
Voting in the recent general elections was a form of resistance. PM Modi talks about a new Kashmir. If new Kashmir means prices will go up, then we don't want new Kashmir.
We want our old Kashmir back.
What exactly is the idea of development for them?
In the heart of the region's capital city, Srinagar, I meet first-time voter, 24-year-old Maliha Sophie. She has decided not to vote because the elections for her hold little hope. Peace in the region, she says, has come at the cost of personal liberties.
Where is the peace, actually? Like, obviously, I know the peace is only this thing that people don't speak like they used to against whatever was happening. But now we are not allowed to say, so yeah, everything is peaceful because nobody speaks against them.
But the Bharatiya Janata Party says there is peace. And the burden of conveying this message here is on one prominent BJP face.
We're in central Srinagar and we've just arrived at the office of Engineer Ejaz, a BJP candidate who is contesting from a constituency in the Srinagar area.
Assalamu alaikum.
Engineer Saab, andar
hai? Door to door ja rahe. Ye hamari uplabdhi hai.
This is our achievement. Elections have happened in the past too, but now voter turnout has increased. Today, people are expressing their trust in democracy.
That's their pitch as the Hindu Nationalist Party tries to make inroads in a Muslim-majority region where it has never had much presence.
I'm in Srinagar at a BJP rally, walking alongside a convoy of cars. The cars are winding through roads with houses lined on both sides. But as we've seen in other rallies, you usually see locals come out onto the roads trying to catch a glimpse of their local candidate. But that seems to be missing over here.
BJP is still seen here as the party responsible for taking away Kashmir's autonomy. Its government in New Delhi blamed for crushing any dissent. A charge Ejaz takes a hard line on while speaking to me.
Our country is a democratic one. We won't allow terrorists to roam freely on our roads. This is our clear stance. We don't want a system of separatism.
All those people who are with separatists, they will be dealt very seriously.
As Kashmiris go about their daily lives, they are also aware of another reality. Even after a new government takes over in this federally administered region, real power will remain in the hands of the centre.
That was the BBC's India correspondent Arunoday Mukherjee reporting from Kashmir. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall. This is NewsHour. Do stay with us. A lot more to come in the next 30 minutes.
Schon viel über Kryptowährungen gehört, aber noch keinen richtigen Zugang gefunden? Der Einstieg in Kryptowährungen muss nicht kompliziert sein. Mit Xtrackers ETCs kannst du kostengünstig in die Zukunft investieren. Einfach übers klassische Depot. Auf xtrackers.de findest du viel Wissenswertes zu dieser spannenden Anlageklasse. Nimm deine finanzielle Zukunft selbst in die Hand. Schritt für Schritt mit Xtrackers. Investitionen unterliegen Risiken. Dieser Beitrag ist eine Werbemitteilung der DWS International GmbH, Frankfurt.
I'm Katja Adler from the Global Story podcast. Today we're looking at Sudan and the brutal conflict raging there. We hear from some of the millions of civilians brutalized and displaced. It's been dubbed the Forgotten War. But is it more ignored than forgotten by the international community? And if so, why? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
You're with NewsHour. September brings the wine harvest for major European wine producers, which this year have again seen their yields hard hit by a changing climate. While new wine regions are emerging with better growing conditions for traditional wine regions, drought and rising temperatures are posing a big challenge. Sophie Eastor from the BBC's Climate Question podcast has been to Catalonia in northeastern Spain to see how one winemaker is adapting.
We are in Mas la Plana, a vineyard. So here we have very, very old vines.
Josep Sabarich is the chief winemaker at Familia Torres, one of the oldest family wine companies in Spain. The family has been making wine here since 1870, but now it's facing a huge challenge.
We have a big drought period, having half yield in the vineyards as an average in the area.
Wow, you had half as many grapes grown as a normal year.
Yes, because when the drought periods are too long, another thing appears that was unexpected in the area is the death of the plants.
For the grapes that do survive, higher temperatures mean they ripen 2 weeks earlier, and that affects the taste and character of the wine.
The aromas are evolving from fresh or green fruit to ripe and then overripe and jammy fruits. You have more sugar in the grapes, so more sugar means more alcohol in the wines.
A recent study found that 90% of traditional wine regions in lowland Spain, Greece, Italy and Southern California could disappear by the end of this century if they don't adapt. The Torres family have started planting grapes at altitude to get away from the scorching heat.
We have been producing grapes in the Pyrenees at 1,000 meters. If you go up, the temperatures are very low comparing to here, so that's good for the plants.
In a test vineyard, I saw one of their other strategies. Mireia Torres is part of the family's fifth generation of winemakers. Using announcements in the local press, she's been leading a grape hunt across the region.
Then we have Cerello, Bronza, Gonfals, Moneu, Solana, Querol.
Mireia's found 60 varieties so far, some of which are more resistant to drought and ripen later, which helps with higher temperatures. She hopes they'll be the climate-proof wines of the future.
And this is the Forcada. This is the white variety. It was an old lady that has several old vineyards, and we found more than one variety in these vineyards. So it was a very good day.
Finding the vine is just the start of a long 12-year process to get it checked for viruses and officially approved. As the world warms, you might start noticing more unfamiliar grape varieties on the market as places like Spain try to keep the wine flowing.
That was the BBC's Sophie Eastor reporting from Catalonia in northeastern Spain. And this is NewsHour. You're listening to the BBC World Service coming to you live from London. I'm Julian Marshall. And earlier in the programme, we heard about the impact of the intensifying Israeli airstrikes in southern Lebanon, directed, says Israel, against Hezbollah targets. The Lebanese authorities have just updated the figures, nearly 500 dead, among them more than 90 women and children, and more than 1,600 injured. Lebanon's health minister also spoke to us about an exodus from the south, thousands of people fleeing north. And online images have shown lines of traffic on roads in towns and cities heading north to Beirut and in the capital itself. Nafise Konovad is a BBC reporter in Beirut, and she's been visiting a school which has been commandeered to accommodate some of those evacuees.
We are in front of a school, one of the many schools that they have prepared it in Beirut to receive displaced people who are coming from the south. And right now, a lot of people are arriving. Cars are just coming, stopping, dropping those that have been displaced. People are so tired. There have been some patients, even and elderly, among those that are arriving. And here that I'm sitting, I'm looking towards the school, and there is a darkness here. The school has already lost its electricity. There is no electricity. There is no enough generator here to light this school. And already there are more than 100 people inside. Those in charge of receiving these people told us that the school can receive more than 1,000 people and will accommodate them. We saw that they are bringing mattresses and blankets for people, and it seems they are preparing to host them for a long time.
Who's going to look after them, Nafise, in the school?
In the school, it is Hezbollah and Hezbollah's allied group, Amal Party, which is another Shia party in Lebanon. And also, mainly, it is Lebanese government. They told us they have been preparing this school for months. It shows that, actually, they were expecting that such day will arrive.
I would imagine this is all very difficult for the Lebanese government at the moment.
Yes, definitely. For example, some people were stopping near our camera, asking us that, you are pressed, you would know, will there be any fuel crisis? This country is facing fuel crisis already. And people, taxi drivers, were worried that with these many people that moving towards Beirut, now they cannot find fuel for their cars. This is the smallest concern that now everyone has. And generators also rely on fuel. And this many generators, if they want to use for the schools, with this many people inside, you can imagine what kind of situation the Beirut itself will be, while a part of Beirut is already being hit.
That was Nafise Konovad, a BBC reporter in Beirut. Well, Israel's stated military goal in southern Lebanon is to degrade Hezbollah sufficiently that the militia no longer poses a threat with their rocket attacks on those Israelis living in northern Israel, and they can return home. More than 60,000 Israelis have been evacuated from the north. Among them was Daniela Porat Penso. She's from the small community or kibbutz of Yiftach, just a kilometre or so from the Lebanese border. But a few months ago, she decided to return, one of a handful to do so. NewsHour's Tim Franks asked her what it was like in the kibbutz now.
It's very quiet, as in, you know, the kibbutz is, I mean, nobody's there except for me and some other maybe 10 or so civilians and our defense squad. You know, we hear the bombing in Lebanon. We hear the bombing in Israel, bomb drones flying over us. So we have alarms. But other than that, when there's nothing like that, it's very quiet and very tense.
When you say you hear drones overhead, these are drones that have what? Are flying out of southern Lebanon?
Yes, there are a lot of them.
Yeah, and I mean, have you been targeted? Has the kibbutz been targeted?
I don't know if it's the main target, but when our defense detects them, sometimes they're being shot in the air above us, and sometimes they just move on and being going to somewhere else. I don't know if we're the target. It's a small place.
Sure. And when the sirens go off saying that you may be under attack, how long have you got to get to a safe place?
Nothing. No time.
It's just drop everything and go.
Yes. I mean, and sometimes, you know, I'm in my kitchen and I hear the siren, and on my way to the safe room, I hear like an interception or something like that.
Right.
So there's no real time. I'm sad to say that I'm used to it.
Yeah. But given that you're just, I mean, a kilometer or two from the border.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why have you decided to go back to your kibbutz?
I saw no good reason why not to. I mean, I was tired of being away from home. I was away from home 7 or 8 months. And I kept wondering about, you know, going from here to there. And I really missed my home. And I felt that I'm not afraid. I don't know, maybe I'm unique in that, but I'm not afraid. And I don't have small children. I just have my dogs. And I'm only responsible for myself. And I have a car so I can, you know, drive away whenever I need to. It's just a choice. It's a choice between two bad things. And that's what I decided.
And Daniela, I don't know how far you're willing to talk about this, but I have spoken to other people who either still do live in the north of Israel or did live in the north of Israel and have been evacuated elsewhere. Mm-hmm. A decent number of them say they don't particularly want war with Hezbollah, but they do say we have to do something about this. We have to do something about the fact that so many people have been forced to flee their homes. And so if there is a big operation against Hezbollah, so be it. I mean, can I ask what your thoughts are?
Basically, I don't believe in war. I don't believe in war. I don't believe that war stops war. I cannot tell you whether it's a good thing or it will be a good result if we have a war, a whole war with Hezbollah or not. I have no idea. I just have my view on life.
Yeah.
Mind you, I just want to add that we are in war already for 11 months. People say we have to have a war with Hezbollah. We have a war with Hezbollah, but I'm an optimist and I'm a peace seeker. So I have to keep my hope up.
That was Daniela Porat-Pense speaking from a kibbutz in northern Israel, just a kilometer or so from the Lebanese border. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. And let's return once again to our main story this hour, the major outbreak of hostilities between Israel and Hezbollah, which has involved heavy Israeli air attacks against Hezbollah targets today in southern Lebanon. It's the deadliest day of conflict, not just since October the 7th last year, but also since 2006. My colleague Edward Sturton has been looking back at the history of cross-border tensions since 1978.
Israeli armour started crossing the border just before midnight. The operation covered the whole of the 75-mile-long frontier from the Mediterranean to the foot of Mount Hermon. The armour went in 6 spearheads with full support units, an operation involving an undisclosed but considerable number of men.
The first incursion was provoked by a Palestinian attack on Israel, which came close to Tel Aviv and left dozens of civilians dead. The Israelis pushed Palestinian forces north of the River Litani in southern Lebanon, and tens of thousands of Lebanese civilians were displaced. But it didn't stop Palestinian fighters keeping up their pressure. So 4 years later, the Israelis returned with an all-out invasion force, bombing Beirut and pushing right up to the outskirts of the capital.
The Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon, which had long been expected, began with a column of 100 tanks moving north out of the buffer enclave controlled by the Israeli-backed Christian militia towards the ancient port city of Tyre.
The Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and his forces were forced out of Lebanon, but Mr. Arafat left like a conquering hero. With the Palestinian forces gone, the newly formed radical Shia group Hezbollah took up the fight against Israel. The Israelis occupied a strip of southern Lebanon as a so-called security belt following the 1982 invasion. But they faced constant harassment from their new enemy. Israel made two attempts to disrupt Hezbollah's control in 1993 and with Operation Grapes of Wrath in 1996. Both caused huge destruction.
For the Israelis, it was a classic revenge attack. For the people of Beirut, it was the first time in 14 years they'd endured anything like it. Israeli helicopters, jets and warships began by attacking the capital. This afternoon, villages to the south were the target. The Israelis said their action was aimed against Hezbollah guerrillas, who've been blamed for rocket attacks across the Lebanese border into northern Israel in recent days.
Israel controls southern Lebanon with the help of a Lebanese Christian militia known as the South Lebanon Army. But both the SLA and the occupying Israeli forces kept taking casualties. And in 2000, Israel pulled out altogether. But in 2006, following a Hezbollah raid across the border, Israel invaded again.
The scene here is as if a great gash has been cut out of the heart of the city. There are acres of rubble and twisted metal, bits of plaster broken up among them. And where once stood the house of the Hezbollah leader, Hassan Nasrallah, nothing but a gaping hole of the foundations is left to mark the spot.
But even that high-intensity conflict failed to disarm Hezbollah. A couple of years later, Israel's defence minister noted that the number of rockets being launched into Israel had actually increased. Even Israel's senior leaders recognise failure.
I think that the Israeli public opinion expected that it will go too smooth and too quick. And so our friends abroad. We underestimated the enemy.
The BBC's Edward Sturton. The United States is certainly watching the intensifying conflict with growing alarm. The US Defense Department announced today it was sending additional troops to the Middle East in response to this escalation of violence between Israel and Hezbollah. The State Department has also warned Americans to leave Lebanon. So does the United States now believe that an all-out war in Lebanon is inevitable and with it the risk of a wider regional conflict, and that there's no room left for diplomacy? David Hale is a former US ambassador in Lebanon and now with the Wilson Center in Washington.
It's a very risky moment. Several thresholds have been crossed, which, of course, for any government, certainly the American government, creates an obligation on our part to warn American citizens of those dangers and to, if necessary, advise them to get out of harm's way. So it is, in fact, meant not to be in and of itself a political signal, but simply the obligation we have to our citizens. But that said, you do have to wonder if American diplomacy is being as effectively deployed as it could be.
I mean, what should America be doing? What could America be doing at the moment beyond calling on Israel for restraint?
I don't think the Israelis have been listening to the American administration on the issue of restraint since October 7. The mindset there is fundamentally changed. And so I don't think just calling for that is going to really be anything that makes a difference. What the United States has to do at this stage is, if it wants to avoid the potential for a really full-blown war between Hezbollah and Israel, is offer a viable diplomatic and political alternative path that convinces the Israelis that there really will be something different in terms of their security and stability and reestablish deterrence in the north. And so far, the United States has not been able to do that, partly, I think, because, frankly, the protagonist is in Tehran, not really in so much in Beirut.
I mean, there is a solution, isn't there, ostensibly, which is to secure a ceasefire in Gaza and the existence of the Israeli offensive against Hamas in Gaza is what Hezbollah sites for its increased rocket attacks into northern Israel.
I think that would be true if, insofar as one looks only from the prism of the Iranians and Hezbollah. Obviously, they started, joined into this conflict on October 8. There's no real Lebanese interest at stake here, and they would be happy to go back to the pre-October 7 scenario where they have the hand on the spigot of violence over Israel. But that prism doesn't work if you apply it to the Israeli point of view. For them, they will not just go back to the pre-October 7. It's a never-again mentality, and they may be groping for a solution. Their military approaches may not, at the end of the day, work. But absent a diplomatic alternative that addresses the issues of northern Lebanon, I don't think that anything else is going to deter them. And in fact, the more Gaza is perceived by the Israelis to be under control, not resolved, but even just under control, I think that creates the moment of truth for them. What are we going to do about the north now that they have the perhaps more freedom of maneuver, more assets that are available for a second campaign up there?
Do you have the feeling that in these dying days of the Biden administration, there's just not the stamina, perhaps, to tackle this conflict?
Well, I don't know if I would use the word stamina, but I'm struck by the fact that none of the parties seem to have been paying much attention to the United States' admonitions and advice when it comes to diplomatic and political approaches. Obviously, Israel welcomes our military assistance, but they have not, nor have their adversaries, paid much attention to our diplomatic approach. And I think that your point is, of course, that as the Biden administration moves into its twilight days, we call it a lame duck period, that they will have less and less ability to influence events, even beyond the limited space they have now.
That was David Hale, a former U.S. ambassador in Lebanon and now with the Wilson Center in Washington. And that's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
Schon viel über Kryptowährungen gehört, aber noch keinen richtigen Zugang gefunden? Der Einstieg in Kryptowährungen muss nicht kompliziert sein. Mit Xtrackers ETCs kannst du kostengünstig in die Zukunft investieren. Einfach übers klassische Depot. Auf xtrackers.de findest du viel Wissenswertes zu dieser spannenden Anlageklasse. Nimm deine finanzielle Zukunft selbst in die Hand. Schritt für Schritt mit Xtrackers. Investitionen unterliegen Risiken. Dieser Beitrag ist eine Werbemitteilung der DWS International GmbH, Frankfurt.
I'm Katja Adler from the Global Story podcast. Today we're looking at Sudan and the brutal conflict raging there. We hear from some of the millions of civilians brutalized and displaced. It's been dubbed the Forgotten War. But is it more ignored than forgotten by the international community? And if so, why? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.